Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was quoted in an introduction of animal rights in South Africa, and he said, "I have seen firsthand how injustice gets overlooked
when the victims are perceived as powerless or vulnerable, when they have no one to speak up for them and no means of representing themselves to a higher authority. Animals are in precisely that position. Unless we are mindful of their interests and speak out loudly on their behalf, abuse and cruelty goes unchallenged. In seeing and understanding kindred animals, we see and understand a part of ourselves." Well, this coming week it will be the week for animals in laboratories. And that starts tomorrow, April the 18th, and goes on till the 26th. There is a growing array of non-animal research methods rendering animal experimentation increasingly obsolete. The animal experiments conducted today could be eliminated with the implementation of non-animal methods without risk to human health. The rat is different from the mouse, and they are all different from the human being. Aspirin kills cats, and penicillin kills guinea pigs. Sheep can swallow enormous quantities of arsenic. Every year, millions of animals are forced to endure pain, loneliness, and despair in Canadian laboratories, including those at UBC, SFU, BC Children's Hospital, VGH, the Rick Hansen-funded ICORD Center on West 10th, and St. Paul's Hospital. Yes, you are listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, which is a non-commercial, cooperatively owned, listener-supported community radio station located in the heart of downtown Vancouver. Alan Jensen, thank you for being our technician. My name is Carl Loskin. Shortly we'll be speaking with Joanne Chang, who is the spokesperson for the Humane Society International Canada. And then at the half-hour mark, Alexandra Morton. What a wonderful person. And she lived on the coast for 26 years studying killer whales and has been talking to government regarding stopping salmon aquaculture. Over to you, Marge.
Thank you, Carl. I want to remind our listeners about the spring membership drive that Alan mentioned a bit earlier. It's time to renew your membership, or if you're not yet a member, become one. We need your help in order to keep Animal Voices on the air. As many of you know, each spring and fall, every program on Co-op Radio is given a quota. And we have received our quota for this spring. We need your help to get to that quota. So please give us a call at 604-684-8494. We're fortunate to have John Pranger, one of our ex-co-hosts, on the line. And John will be very pleased to hear from you. I want to also tell you a little bit about the why we need money. Co-op Radio is staffed largely by volunteers. All of we programmers are volunteers. And, of course, we devote our labor and our fondness for the station without any retribution. There are only 4 part-time paid staff members at the radio station, and you can imagine that is a pretty light staffing, but we seem to manage and have done for, 32 years, I believe?
34
now. Ooh, the time goes by. But we have no advertisers, so we don't have any allegiance to sponsors who will be trying to direct what goes on to the radio, and we can freely express opinions that may not be that popular. It's the only completely independent radio station in this area. CFRO depends on the generosity of our listeners. Their support has kept it going all these years, and we hope we'll be generous. You will be generous this time and keep us on the air. So please give John a call at 604-684-8494, and he'll be very pleased to receive your call.
I just, before we go to the interview, I'd just like to mention for people who want to join on Animal Voices today, we have a couple of great premiums to induce you, to help you get yourself over to the telephone. There's two DVDs, one featuring Ingrid Newkirk and one featuring Howard Lyman. And we'll say more about those later, but if you want to get one of those, you want to call soon because they'll get snapped up. These are great things to get. So regular membership is $60 a year, but if you want one of these DVDs, maybe you can consider, if you can afford to give more than $60 a year. But and you can pay by Visa or MasterCard when you call in. But so we have these two great DVDs, one by Ingrid Newkirk, one by Howard Lyman, and we'll tell you more about that later. But if you want to get one for sure, call up now.
Yes, thank you for the pitch there. And we really need all our contributors and all our listeners. So we'd like to acknowledge a very generous gift from Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, that's CETFA, who are first on the list, today. Thank you, CETFA. So, Joanne Chang is the spokesperson for the Humane Society International Canada. And welcome to Animal Voices, Joanne.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me on the show.
That's great. Now, one of your main agendas that you've been working on recently is about the bears and the trophy hunting of bears. And so how are you going about dealing with that?
Well, right now, if you flip through the Vancouver Sun today, you'll see a full-page ad by Humane Society International about the bear hunt. There's a picture of a bear cub in the front, and that's to convey the fact that spring bear hunting is especially unethical. At this time, we opened up the spring hunt in the Great Bear Rainforest in BC. From April 1st all the way until June 30th, people can come in and shoot the bears for a trophy, which is basically for entertainment purposes. At this time, the bears are just waking up from a long winter's hibernation. The bears actually give birth in the den during hibernation, and right now they're waking up. Their babies are starving. They're going out to the water to fish to bring back to the cubs. What the mother cubs usually do is leave the baby cubs at the base of a tree a little bit farther away from her while she goes fishing. And that's where they're taken down by the trophy hunters. Just gunning down these animals is extremely cruel. But the other part of it is what happens to the cubs. They're left at the base of the trees. They don't know how to fend for themselves. They'll just starve to death.
Now, when these hunters come, they shoot a grizzly bear, and they can't tell whether it's a male or female. They basically look the same. And so, I mean, the females must be shot in the spring hunt, and then of course we have these baby cubs helpless, walking around, and their mortality would be high.
Exactly, and they claim that they don't shoot the female bears, and like you said, from far away they can't even tell how big the animal is. They just shoot these animals. How would they know if it's a male or a female? The idea of trophy hunting is take down the biggest and most robust animals. And what does that leave the gene pool with? The weakest and the sickest ones. So that is a sure way to ensure that, you know, that species won't survive.
Now, there's been a public relations attempt by our present provincial government, right, to downplay this controversy by creating no hunting areas after the hunting season is over. I mean,
exactly. And you know, the areas that they have announced, they say, oh, it's this many hectares, it's great, but in reality, these areas are very small and separated. So you have wide-ranging animals like bears. They're constantly going in and out of these no-hunting zones, so they're not really being protected at all. And in addition to that, who's out in the forest regulating which area is a hunting zone and which one is not? It's all a self-regulated industry.
Now, one also has to wonder about our provincial government
in Victoria, because I think it was last year they made an amendment to the BC Wildlife Act to promote more boys and girls, like kids, going out hunting. I mean, what is the impact of people who are not all that skilled with a rifle to go out there and go and shoot these animals?
Exactly, and that's what happens with trophy hunting too. You have rich people who might not know how to operate a gun that well go out and shoot these animals. Oftentimes the animals are wounded and they escape and they will die a slow death. Another thing about trophy hunting of bears is that grizzly bears are some of the most slowest reproducing animals in North America. It takes a grizzly bear about 6 to 7 years before they're sexually mature enough to get pregnant. And some of them don't even survive to that age. And when they do, if there's not enough food, they don't get enough food to get fat enough to hibernate through the winter. What their body will do is automatically they won't carry the pregnancy through. They will just abort.
So they don't have the body fat. And, of course, there's a relationship between the bears, the forest, and the salmon. And so, I mean, that's what they like to feed on and gives them the body fat they need.
Yes, and that's something that the coastal First Nations, who are very, very against this trophy hunting in their traditional territory, that's what they talk about, is that, you know, the bears are a part of the ecosystem. Without the bears, there could be dire consequences for the rainforest.
So I'll say it in another way, Joanne, is that the bears are a part of the ecosystem, but do they upset the natural balance which has been in place and perfected over millions of years?
Exactly, and like I said before, when you're killing the biggest and most robust animals, leaving the sickest and weakest, it doesn't make any sense that our provincial government is in full support of this trophy hunt when they don't even know how many bears there are out there. They've never even tried to estimate the number of black bears. And the black bears are quite special because 1 out of 10 of them carry this recessive gene that makes a white bear, the spirit bear, we call it. And those spirit bears are actually more rare than panda bears. So for every black bear you're taking out, you're decreasing the gene pool for the spirit bears.
Now, we do see, of course, there's alternatives to this, and you're going to present that shortly. But, you know, while we're dealing with the two aspects here of, you know, the hunting and how the government is permitting this, the setting aside the areas after the hunt is over and promoting hunting for girls and boys. So, but as a reflection on our politicians in Victoria, I'd like to compare them to the European politicians, because in Europe, as I know it, no ambitious politician would want to be seen with a hunting rifle in sights aiming at a cuddly animal or endangered species. And these grizzly bears, they are endangered, are they?
They're threatened in the U.S., so they can't hunt them, so they come up here to hunt them. They're listed under special concern here, which means their population is in danger as well. The Europeans, they pretty much, you know, they made the mistake. They've hunted their wildlife out of existence, so they really, really, truly appreciate the fact that we still have some of that wildlife left. So this is why the bear viewing industry in the Great Bear Rainforest area is doing so well. It's bringing in so much more income than any of this trophy hunting combined. And, you know, people come from Europe, all over the world. They pay big money just to watch these bears, just to watch them forage with their cubs and take pictures of them. And, you know, by allowing this trophy hunt to continue, not only are they killing the bears, they're killing this robust industry that's growing out of that area, and they're all resident owned. So all the money is going into BC's economy, and which makes no sense that the premier and the provincial government is trying to take that away from the people.
Now, I saw that there was one operation on Knight Inlet that grossed $3 million in 2007. This was just one operation that was involved with bringing in people to view the grizzly bears and
yep.
to see the area. I mean, one has to wonder where the allegiance is here, you know, the environment mm-hmm. or appeasing a small group of people who come here. Which is also amazing is that the First Nations people have always known never to eat a grizzly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this is why we're lending our support to them, that they've been trying to talk to the government for years and years to try to end this hunt. And you know, the government will not budge on this issue. So this is why we're the animal rights community is stepping in to try to make it a more public issue.
Now, you have a full-page advert in today's Vancouver Sun.
Yes.
Maybe, I haven't seen it, but maybe you can just tell us what your objective was to put the advert and what people can do.
Well, right now, the provincial election is coming up May 12th, and we know that the current government is in full support of the trophy hunting of bears. We think right now is more important than ever because now they're listening to people. They're taking comments. We're asking people to go onto our website, which is hsicanada.ca/protectbears. And you can go on there, and there's an online form that you can fill out to send to Premier Gordon Campbell and let him know that you do not support the trophy hunting of bears. And 78% of British Columbians do not support this as well. So far, we've had thousands and thousands of emails going into the Premier, and we would just like to keep that coming during this election campaign.
So I'll just repeat that. You go to www.hsicanada.ca, and there's a little place there where you can click on a little bear. Mm-hmm. And HSI stands for Humane Society International Canada, and it's hsicanada.ca. And maybe, you know, we're having on the West Coast, it's happening right now. They're shooting the grizzly bears, but on the East Coast, much worse things are happening, and you're also involved in that.
Yep, we're doing a campaign to try to stop the slaughter of seals on the East Coast. Each year, about 300,000 baby seals are slaughtered for fur. And this, again, is supported by our government. The pelts aren't making any money. Nobody's buying those seal pelts, so which is why it makes no sense that our government is continuing this hunt.
Now, what really gets me about this was that there was the good ship Farley Mowat, and the government, the federal government, has latched onto this boat, is keeping it. And, you know, it's very contentious as to whether they had actually been into an area where, you know, which was a no-zone area because you can't come within a certain number of feet of somebody using the haka pick or whatever onto these baby seals. But this grabbing of the boat is so monstrous.
Right, and all they're trying to do is document what's happening, and the government doesn't want that to be seen because they know that what they're doing is wrong. What they're doing is extremely cruel, even though they justify it by saying it's a humane hunt. And when people come closer to just document it, they get their ships taken. So, you know, I don't think they feel that it's humane. Certainly they don't want people to see it.
Now, we're speaking with Joanne Chang. She's a spokesperson for Humane Society International Canada, hsicanada.ca. You have a broad spectrum, so maybe you can just tell us why. I mean, you've already said two major issues here that you feel close to and encourage, but maybe say something about the organization. I mean, being able to fund a full-page advert, that's incredible.
Yeah, Humane Society International is one of the largest animal rights organizations in Canada, not in Canada, in the world. We're affiliated with Humane Society United States, and there are campaigns all over the world.
So maybe just give a little brief rundown of some of their world and U.S. activities.
Yeah, back in November, I believe, HSUS was quite involved in the campaign to bring forward Proposition 2 in California, which came through, and now they have banned all confinement of farm animals, which includes sow crates and battery cages and veal crates.
Well, that was a gigantic victory, Joanne, that California, which normally sets the pace for the rest of the United States, to have Proposition 2 passed for somewhat alleviating the torture that goes on in the factory farm situations. But it's a start.
And the fight is still very long. You know, how we talk about this is such a great victory, and people that are opposed to animal rights say, oh, how come animals now have more rights than humans? But you got to think about what we won there. It's basically just for these animals to be able to stretch their limbs, to turn around, to sit down and stand up. That is all that was all about. It's good in a way that's won, but it's sad in a way that was considered a huge victory. And just think about the billions and billions of animals that are currently suffering in factory farms. They can't even turn around. That is just very atrocious, I think.
Now, in the last minute we have is, maybe you can just summarize the provincial issue here with the trophy hunting of grizzly bears. Maybe just summarize what we say, and over to you.
Yeah, I just wanted everybody to write Premier Gordon Campbell before May 12th and let him know that you don't support grizzly bear hunting in the Great Bear Rainforest, and that you're a concerned citizen and you don't tolerate that.
Thank you very much, Joanne Chang, for being on Animal Voices.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
Bye for now.
Take care.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org. So, well, anyway, over to you, Ellen or Marge. What's in store for the next? Do we have some sweet tunes?
Well, we have lots of sweet tunes, but the sweetest tune of all is the phone. The sound of the phone ringing around here. To hear that phone ringing during fundraising time. And so I'd like to encourage people to get musical and go over and punch out the little tones on your phone and cause the phone over here to ring that nice sweet song it does, and support Co-op Radio. The phone number here is 684-8494, area code 604, 684-8494, 684-8494. And tell John or whoever answers the phone that you'd like to support Co-op Radio and become a member of Co-op Radio, and then we can take care of you.
Well, you know, you said that I should sing a song, and then I would stop singing when the phone rings.
I think that's a splendid idea.
So I just like to say, remind people that we have a couple of great giveaways here. Yeah, our next guest is on the phone. We have a couple of great giveaways here. Howard Lyman, the Mad Cowboy Lecture, Saving the Earth One Bite at a Time. And you can have this is a DVD, and you can have a copy of that. Or we have Speaking Up for Animals, two keynote addresses by PETA President Ingrid Newkirk. These are two wonderful giveaways you can have. You can have either of these if you call and join Co-op Radio at the regular membership price, which is $60 a year, or consider becoming a monthly sustainer where you give $10, $15, or $20 a month to Co-op Radio. If you can afford more than $60 at a crack, that's great. Give whatever you can. Co-op Radio needs that money. You can pay whatever you're able to afford. No amount is too small or no amount is too big. The important thing is to support Co-op Radio. It takes hundreds and hundreds of people every year joining Co-op Radio to keep the station on the air. You can pay by Visa or MasterCard, or we'll send you a package with a return envelope in it, and you can send in a check, whatever's easy for you. You can also pay for the monthly sustainer membership by Visa or MasterCard. But what's really important is that you join us in keeping Co-op Radio on the air. Co-op Radio gets no money from big business. We get a tiny amount of money from the government. The city of Vancouver gives us a small cultural grant, and that's it. The money comes from listeners, people like you, who know that it's really, really important to have a community radio station here that brings you critical public affairs and great music programming all year round, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year. It takes money to do this, unfortunately, and that's up to you to join us. We come down here and volunteer and put the shows on, but we're all members too, of course, but it's up to you to join the hundreds and thousands of other people who help to pay what they can to keep Co-op Radio on the air. 684-8494.
Yes, and thank you to those who have already called. Thank you, thank you. Alexandra Morton has lived on the coast for 26 years studying killer whales. And she's been talking with the government, restocking salmon aquaculture. She's also author of wonderful books called Listening to the Whales, What the Orcas Have Taught Us, and another book in the Company of Whales, From the Diary of a Whale Watcher. That's Alexandra Morton. And then she co-authored a book with Stephen Hume, a well-known Vancouver journalist. That was called A Stain Upon the Sea, West Coast Salmon Farming. Welcome to Animal Voices, Alexandra Morton.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yes, and you know, maybe you can tell us, what have the orcas taught us?
Well, many things. The most important thing to our orcas on this coast is their family. And they will go to great lengths to remain together. The offspring stay with their mothers their whole lives. It's incredibly tight. They start breathing together when they're born, and this might continue the rest of their life. I've also learned that they're very optimistic animal. They tend to make the best of a situation. I learned this particularly in the tragic years that I studied them in captivity, and we started, many of us, in captivity, but in learning about who they are, realized just how inappropriate and horrible it was to have them in these tanks. And now today I've learned that they're very tolerant neighbors. They will tolerate a great many things and excuse a lot of things from us, but they do need to have their food and they need to be able to socialize. And now what I realize is it's up to us to make it possible for them to make a living near us.
Now, Alexandra Morton, it's been said that you think that salmon farms have driven away the killer whales. So how do you explain that?
Well, it was very simple, and I, of course, didn't know what I was watching as I was watching it, but they arrived in this beautiful remote archipelago in the October of 1984, and the whales that I was working with, the northern resident clans, the A clans and G clans, use that area, and I became very familiar with them and learned how they use the inlets during the winter. And then the fish farm showed up first in 1987, and everything went along pretty well for the first 5 years. But then they began to play sounds underwater. They had speakers by their pens, and they produced a sound that's 198 decibels. So that's as loud as a jet airplane at takeoff, right at the engine. And they did this to try to keep the seals from eating their fish, because the farm fish are extremely fat and the seals crave that, and the farm fish were easy to catch even through the nets. And so they put these sounds on, and the families came in as normal, one after the next, and experienced this sound and never came back. They eventually learned that these sound devices actually attracted seals. They call it a dinner bell effect. Apparently the seals were willing to risk their hearing in exchange for the fat in these farm animals, but the whales were not. because their hearing is their primary sense. And I think for them, it was like it might be for us walking into a room full of needles coming at our eyeballs. It would be terrifying, and you wouldn't do it twice.
Right.
And that's what I've seen. So they tolerated a great deal, and then this was one thing they just couldn't take.
Now, in these aquaculture fish farms, they keep mostly Atlantic salmon. Now, is it true that the orca will not eat Atlantic salmon?
Well, you know, so much of the whale's life is underwater that we don't really know what they do. They certainly don't break into the pens, which they could do. When they were capturing them with nets, there were some individuals that would punch their way out of the net and then punch their way back in to be with their gang. So they could, but they don't at the moment see them as food. And the problem with farming these animals, these salmon in the water, is that all the predators become pests. And as pests, they can be removed, shot, or trapped. And so instead of feeding the ocean around them, these little private spaces that the companies are claiming now exclude predators. And worse than that, what happens is that the viruses and bacteria and parasites get into the pens because it's just nets and the currents are very fast and they flow. And so as the wild animals go by, they're always shedding a few of these germs. And they get in the pen, and then without predators, and because the fish are stationary and crowded, these pathogens reproduce rapidly. And then they pour out again, because it's only nets, at levels that the wild fish simply are not designed or able to deal with. And so I've spent now the last 8 years studying sea lice, but only because they're the easiest of this group of things to study. They're big and you can see them on the fish. But what's happening with the bacteria and the viruses is even more disturbing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so like in 2003, there was a transfer of the virus IHN from the wild sockeye heading down towards the Fraser River, and it transferred into the farms. And from there, it spread to 6 or 7 farms in eastern Johnson Straits. And then when they came by in their boats carrying the young farm salmon, they picked up the virus and they brought it to where I live in the Broughton Archipelago. And from those infected fish, another 5 or 6 farms became infected. And then the same thing happened, and they took the disease to the Port Hardy area and also up to the central coast of Bella Bella. And so the fish farmers say, oh, you know, don't worry, we have not imported a new disease, it's all natural diseases, and for now they're correct. But diseases are in balance with the organisms that they live in, otherwise we'd all be dead. And so we keep them in check, and what these feedlots do is they allow them to explode. And the really very frustrating, disturbing thing is that they don't even acknowledge this problem. I was just at a meeting on Tuesday where a fish farm company called Grieg is trying to get 2 more really big sites on the migration route of the Fraser River fish, and they wouldn't acknowledge that sea lice are a problem or that their farms produce tons of waste and it collects on the seafloor. They wouldn't acknowledge that my community is suffering from this and all but gone. And so there's absolutely no progress going on in the big picture with this industry. And so I'm quite determined at this point to try to inspire the government to apply the laws of Canada to these facilities. And you would think that would be easy because it is the law, but I've been circulating a letter asking for the Fisheries Act to be applied to these salmon feedlots. 12,000 people, over 12,000 people have signed it, and the Minister of Fisheries and the Premier of the province, Gordon Campbell, have not even acknowledged that he has received this letter, and I send it every week.
So now maybe you can tell people where they can go to and sign your letter.
Yeah, that would be great. It's the website's called Adopt A Fry. So it's Adopt-A-Fry. A fry is a young salmon, and this started last spring where I was going to pick up the young fish after they entered the salt water and put them into a tank and just move them several kilometers past these feedlots so they wouldn't get eaten by the lice. And the government said I wasn't allowed to do that, that I might hurt them. So I didn't actually do that, but I went to court to try to prevent those very farms from getting bigger, because the First Nations in my area of the Broughton have decided that they don't want these farms to get bigger. They don't even want them to be able to renew their leases. And but the farms are going ahead with trying very hard to do that. And so I went to court, and at the moment is a big question as to whether these Norwegian companies even own their salmon once they put them into Canadian waters. And so I won that case, and now the fish farms are supposed to be managed by the federal government, not the provincial government. But everything's kind of in limbo because the fish farm company, Marine Harvest, has appealed this decision. And so it may go back to the province, and that's why I'm also writing Premier Campbell. And so we're asking for just three sections of the Fisheries Act to be applied. We just want them to turn off their lights at night because it attracts all kinds of organisms into and around the pens. We want them to put licenses on their packers like every other boat on this coast. And we want to know what else is in their pens and fish. How much herring, how much black cod, how many wild fish are being sucked up and killed in this industry? Because if you're trying to manage herring or black cod or juvenile salmon, and there's this big hole into which they're vanishing at an unknown number, you can't manage them properly.
Now, Alexandra, the webpage is adopt-a-fry, is it .ca or .com or what?
.org.
.org.
So it's adopt-a-fry.org.
Okay, I'll say that again. Adopt-a-fry.org. Anyway, sign the petition and support Alexandra Morton. Now, these fish farms, it's such an unnatural, cruel situation with so many animals in close confinement and spewing out tremendous amounts of excrement. But also, is it of concern that they're using anti-sea lice pesticides, which eventually ends up in the product that's coming from the fish farms?
Yes, this is a very big concern because, first of all, the drug has not been approved for use in the water. And it was released occasionally as an emergency measure if their fish were being destroyed by sea lice. But when I discovered that the young wild salmon outside the pens were being eaten alive by these lice, because the little salmon, when they come out of the rivers, are not supposed to meet older fish, and they're not supposed to meet sea lice. Nature's very clear about that. She separates the two. So these farms cause this collision. And so in response to my work and the work of others now, they decided to drug the fish. You know, they always go for the lowest denominator. Instead of moving the worst sites, they just apply the drug. So now we have this drug called Slice. It's a neurotoxin, and it damages the ability for these lice to make a shell, because actually sea lice aren't a lice at all. They're a crustacean that live on fish. So this drug potentially threatens prawns and shrimp and crabs, but more fundamental, also the little organisms in the plankton layer that our fish are eating. And they never post a sign saying they are treating with this drug, so the public has no idea. And lots of people fish, both sport fishing, but also what I would call subsistence fishing. The local people live off the water there. And so we never know. And furthermore, their nets are painted red, which is a toxic paint. And birds like surf scoters, you can see them, flocks of hundreds, nibbling the net, getting the mussels and things off of it. And so they are certainly ingesting this poison as well. There's also antibiotic use and other drug use They use a chemical to dye the flesh of their salmon pink because our fish are getting their pinkness from eating shrimp and krill, and these fish are basically being raised on fat, and they're not getting that color. So there's a long list of chemicals.
So now that's put me right off.
Yeah.
We've been vegan for a while, but anyway, that surely must send a message, what you've just said now, to those people who still eat fish, that this product is highly questioned and probably does them more harm, their body more harm, than any benefits that they think could come from it because of the artificial nature and all these pesticides and colorings and, my goodness, it's a horror story.
It is. Tragically, people are used to polluting their bodies. Sometimes when I'm in a lineup at the supermarket and I look at the cart in front of me, I'm amazed that people are alive, you know, with all the chips and synthetic things. And so those chickens that are raised in the battery farms and the pigs and the veal, there's some, you know, there's horror stories across the boards. The problem in particular, in addition with the farms, salmon farms, is that at least those terrestrial farms are closed and they're behind closed doors. But what's happening with these salmon feedlots is because the currents of our ocean travel so much, like in 6 hours, a little block of wood can go 10 kilometers easily. That's without wind. And so these pathogens are just flowing out, and we're getting also toxic algae blooms in our area because the nitrogen and phosphorus that's pouring out, it's basically we have now a huge agricultural runoff into this beautiful little archipelago. And the water turns dark red and brilliant orange. And for anyone who can read the signs, this is a neon flashing warning overload.
Now, Alexandra, Alan, our technician, has a question for you.
Hi, thank you. I'm learning a lot through this interview. But I wanted to ask again about who controls the water. You were mentioning the Fisheries Act earlier and the court case, I guess, that is trying to determine this. But surely we're talking about waters that would be controlled by the federal government. We're talking about the ocean here. So fisheries and oceans should be responsible. But where has the federal government said anything about this?
Well, yeah, this is where we're at right now. So I went to court, and the judge decided it was unconstitutional for the provincial government to be managing these salmon feedlots because they are in the ocean, like you said. And so he gave them 12 months to sort this out. Now, because the fish farm company appealed the decision, that stalls everything and drags it back to the courts, and a big question mark. But that's why I'm saying what they decided was they're not farms, they're not provincially regulated, they are a fishery. And more than that, we don't have any private fisheries. There's no private schools of fish with a brand on them running around in our ocean. You put a fish in our ocean, it's everybody's. So at the moment, there's a big question as to whether they even own their fish. And, of course, for their insurance companies and their shareholders and, you know, their banks, this is a tenuous situation. So actually, the whole industry is an unconstitutional act. It's unlawful. It's not illegal, but it's outside the law. There's no law to cover this. And so the government's trying to figure it out right now. Now, it was supposed to bring jobs, and it's killed my community and several others around. It drove the price of wild salmon down. So it's had many long-range effects. The salmon farming companies are actually in the process of losing money worldwide. These are enormous companies with holdings in Chile and the North Atlantic and Eastern Canada. They're losing money. MLAs who stand for fish farming have lost their seats twice running now in the last two elections. So I'm like, wait, you guys, who is having a good time here? Are you sure we want to carry this on? Because what could happen is you could pull these things off the wild salmon migration routes right now, and then at least we could think about things. But it's an unsustainable process because they have to fish the South Pacific, and then they move all that fish up here, and they grind it up, and they put it back in the water, and then they pull out less fish at enormous planetary cost in the burning of fuels. So, you know, it's one of these vertically integrated corporate systems, which is outside my biological experience, but it's a temporary thing. This is not going to go on forever.
It sounds inefficient in the same way that tar sands exploitation is inefficient. So, but because the tar sands is subsidized, are they getting a government subsidy, or are these big companies just taking a loss for the time being, hoping that in the long run they'll make money?
Well, when they were farms, they got huge tax breaks, which they have now lost. And so they got subsidies in that way, and they've also been given an enormous amount of money in research and development, which is a little bit beyond me why we are doing that. But now aquaculture has a long history in Asia of being quite sustainable, and you take the waste of these fish and you grow a crop of food, vegetable food, and you use part of that crop to raise your fish and part of that crop for you, and so you end up with a fish crop and a vegetable crop, and the waste coming out of the fish is valuable and you use it. And so we could do that on a much smaller scale, but this Norwegian model that's in our water right now, as the price of their fish goes down, the only thing they can think to do is to get bigger. And they are choking off these major migration routes. And salmon are not only wonderful in themselves, they are a power cord from the open ocean up our mountains and everything in between. So any ecosystem or human community that has wild salmon running to it or past it will thrive. And you turn that off, nobody would grow a garden, for example, without feeding it something. Your crops would diminish. Well, that's about our forests. And our forests are making the oxygen that we are breathing and other people on our planet are breathing. So basically, if you're breathing in British Columbia, you need wild salmon.
Now, Washington and Alaska have outlawed, as you call them, salmon feedlots, but BC goes the other way.
Well, Washington has a couple of them, which is interesting. The Norwegians aren't there, but there is a couple of farms. But, yeah, Alaska has banned them from the beginning, and they are harvesting record runs of wild salmon. And also on the western Pacific edge, so the coast of Russia, they also have very large salmon runs. And so when they talk about climate change, there's a few glitches in their argument. Particularly when you look at the western Pacific, because that's at the same latitude as us. I've seen a couple of miracles in the last few years. There's been the steady decline of fish. They get infected with the lice, you know, and they just don't make it back. But every now and then a farm will be empty when a young group of fish go to sea. And so this beautiful little river next to me called the Viner River has chum salmon, and it got down to tens and hundreds of fish every fall, and I thought it was dead. And then last fall there was 17,000 of them, big, beautiful, magnificent chum salmon. That river shed became alive. There was ravens flying up and down, and crows and bears and wolves howling, and there were cougar tracks, and the place smelled of life. And the farm, when those little guys went to sea, was empty. And so we've also got humpback whales back to this area. We have dolphins back. We got sardines back. This ocean is not dead. We are choking it for all we're worth, but it is trying to thrive. And I don't think people have any idea that this whole coast could reignite. We could turn these fish back on, and this is something I am working on. And what it takes is follow the fish, give them what they need. Don't do anything more, don't do anything less, just give them what they need, and they will serve us indefinitely.
Now, people are powerful individuals, and there's so much we all can do, and you've spearheaded this tremendous movement up there because you love the orcas, you love the ocean, you love the place where you lived there for 26 years, but people maybe don't always recognize how powerful they are. And
yeah.
So, in wrapping up, maybe you can just give us your opinion on that.
Well, it's funny because we are the only people with power. Who elects the government? Who buys the products of these corporations? We, the individual, do. And so we have been convinced that we're powerless, but we hold all the power. And particularly when you look around your own place, your own home, your own neighborhood, you know better than anybody what needs to be done. And that's all I'm doing. Lots of people think I'm, you know, altruistic and, you know, so wonderful that I'm helping out these fish. Actually, this is my home, and I'm fighting for my home because I love it and I want to stay in it. And so there's enormous power in that. And every time you spend money, you're feeding a different system. And just make sure you feed the one that is going to be good to you and your children. And away we go.
Alexandra Morton. Morton, and you are the author of Listening to the Whales, What the Orcas Have Taught Us, In the Company of Whales, From the Diary of a Whale Watcher, that's you, and A Stain Upon the Sea, West Coast Salmon. So thank you for telling us all about the orcas, their wonderful lives, and also implanting on us some of the enthusiasm which you have. And tell us what people can do now to go back to that webpage and become involved.
Yeah, go to the webpage, www.adopt-a-fry.org, and sign the letter if you feel like joining us in this. Also, really think before you vote, because this ecosystem here is not going to take the abuse forever, and I believe we're down to the wire at this point.
Thank you, Alexandra Morton, for being on Animal Voices.
Thank you for having me.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, which is our non-commercial, cooperatively owned station. And many of our programs are posted on our webpage. And if you'd like to hear Alexandra Morton again, it'll be on animalvoices.org.
And I was going to say, Carl, maybe if somebody would like a copy of that interview, if they were to become a member of Co-op Radio, you could make them a copy on a CD, and then they could have that to listen to again. Make today's program, we've had two great guests, Joanne Chang, talking mostly about grizzly bears, and Alexandra Morton about salmon and killer whales. And it would be, people would probably enjoy hearing that again, so that would be a good incentive. Though if you want to join today, I'll just remind you that we still have left a copy of the DVD by Ingrid Newkirk called Speaking Up for Animals, and we also have a copy of a DVD featuring Howard Lyman, the Mad Cowboy Lecture, Saving the Earth One Bite at a Time. If you'd like a copy of one of these DVDs, or a copy of today's program, then why not give us a call and join Co-op Radio? Of course, you don't have to take one of these. You can just call up and say you don't really need any of these incentives. You just want to support Co-op Radio and keep us on the air for another year. 684-8494, area code 604, 684-8494. Marge, did you want to add anything about
joining?
Well,
I just want to back up what Alan said here. We're all volunteers here, and we're also supporters in a financial way, but we do need cash. And just to give you an idea of the kind of things we need cash for, and it's not very much for our four paid staff members, but it is for equipment, for supplies, utilities, and various other things that every station needs, and so that. We need to get a good deal of money in during the year in order to keep things rolling. So please give us a call at 604-684-8494 and mention Animal Voices. And if you would like one of these prizes that Alan has mentioned, please ask at that time. John will be on the line. Thank you.
We have a couple of minutes to go before the next program. This is CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and on cooperadio.org around the world. And we are a listener-sponsored station, as we've just been telling you, and we exist because you support Co-op Radio, so do give us a call.
Well, you know, Alan, you're a great bird person, and of course, it's so many birds are on the migratory path right now.
Mm.
And it was very interesting because there was an article in the North Shore News about these different types of hummingbirds, and that there's certain types of hummingbirds that spend the winter here.
The Anna's hummingbirds, yes. But then they require feeders, so people need a hummingbird feeder, and they have to look after it all winter long so the birds don't starve, right? And sometimes it freezes, they have to take the feeder indoor and warm it up, thaw it out, and put it back outside again so the Anna's hummingbirds can survive. But I've been watching one near where I live in Stanley Park. The people there have a feeder, and all winter there's been these hummingbirds.
Right, and also these the snow geese, they're on their way, and they're flying thousands of miles. What a magical system.
Way up in northern Alaska, yeah.
When I hear the Canada geese, and I see about 200 of them flying in a V formation above me, it just absolutely sends shivers down my spine. It's so moving, and I love to hear the honking. Well, Animal Voices is brought to you every Friday at noon. We've been going for some 9 years, Marge. We're getting a bit long in the tooth
here. We are indeed. The program went for many years before we were involved with it. Remember, Rosalind Castles was the one of the originators, and then there was another gentleman. I never did hear him, but from Britain.
David Knowles moved back to Britain, but he was very instrumental in keeping the program going for a couple of years there. So I'm just going to, you can just do a little more pitching, Marge, and I'll be right back.
Oh, okay. If you haven't gone to the phone yet, please do it right now. 684-8494 is the number to remember, and we do need your help, as always. And you've been keeping us going for 34 years, so that you're a good listening audience, and we love to have you with us every Friday, so that keep the dollars rolling and keep the radio going. Thank you.
Yes. In seeing and understanding kindred animals, we see and understand a part of ourselves. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for calling 684-8494. I'm helping to keep Animal Voices on the air and Co-op Radio on the air. 684-8494. Coming up right now is Radio EcoShock, and that's going to be followed at 2 o'clock by the Community Living Show and at 2:30 by the A-Train Jazz Program. And Co-op Radio will keep coming to you all the time, but you need to keep coming to us at least once a year to give a little money. 684-8494 to show your support during our fundraising drive, our membership drive this year.